a couple of weeks ago, and it has morphed into about four lessons. It should have been four, and the first one should have been divided into two. The second one, I think I spent time trying to redo, re-preach some of what I preached the first one. But it's led into this lesson. Tonight I'd like to talk about the teaching of our children and look at some specifics, a couple of specifics I'd like to share with you that I think could be helpful. And then I'll do one more, and that next Sunday morning will be on the power of example and how I believe that's the most important thing that parents will give to their kids is living an example of love for the Lord. Today we're going to talk about raising teenagers. Yes, we are. I'm having one of those moments again. Sorry. And right now, I am just praying to the Lord. The older I get, the worse it gets. That is unbelievable. All right. I'm going to preach from PowerPoint. Because you don't want to hear a redoing of the sermon. So somehow today, off my desk, I picked up these notes, which just infuriates me to no end. Do you want me to preach something else? I guess I'm going to be human today. I'm human every day. What about Proverbs 22, verse 6? As I presented these lessons, I thought about them, and I have found myself enjoying preparing them, but I've also found myself very frustrated. Very, very frustrated at times, because I know there's some areas where I failed. And I so wish that I could have done a better job. And so I'm with you. And you hear these lessons and some struggles we may have. It's okay. It's okay to struggle. Well, what about this passage in Proverbs 22:6? Train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he gets old, he will not depart from it. So there you have it. If you do this right, your children will always be faithful. Well, first of all, there are two things to consider. This is a general proverb. Proverbs are general truths. They are not absolute promises from God and not to be read that way. To illustrate, go back to chapter 10 of Proverbs and appreciate here this passage, Proverbs 10:27. The fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked shall be shortened. Imagine being at a funeral where a 23-year-old who has been killed in a tragic car wreck is suggesting that they weren't righteous because their life wasn't prolonged. Or recognizing there are wicked people who have one good thing after another happen to them, and nothing seemingly bad happens to them. Or 12:21. No grave trouble will overtake the righteous. No grave trouble. Never get sick. Never be told you have cancer. No problems if you're righteous. That's what that passage literally says, right? But the wicked shall be filled with evil. They'll have problems all their life. Well, I know a lot of problems wicked people have because they brought them on themselves. But there are exceptions. And secondly, there's a question of translation. And I believe a legitimate question. When we're looking at the Hebrew, those who know more about it, way more than I do. And that is, it could be translated, if you will, train up a child in his own way. or in the way he seems to naturally be inclined to go, which would fit the concept and fit the character of Proverbs more than in the middle of this chapter, a passage that all of a sudden springs up that gives some spiritual truth that if you raise your children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, following His laws, His will, then everything's going to turn out right for them. They will always be faithful. The tenor of the Proverbs, I think, may suggest that children are different. They have different personalities and abilities and temperaments. And you have to figure that out. By the way, those of us that had boys and girls, did you notice there were some differences? Did you see some children seem to be more apt in some areas than others? And what I can see in this is if you have a son from particular, that you see him having some natural abilities, train him in that way, lead him in that way. If it's academic or if it's mechanical, he's good with his hands, you may actually be helping him develop an occupation or trade for the rest of his life. And he'll be good at that the rest of his life, and he'll never depart from that. That's something he'll be able to hang on to. I can see that understanding in the passage. And even if that's not the way, even if it should be understood, the training here is the spiritual training. Again, remember, please, it is a general proverb. There can be exceptions. The story of Eli comes up now and then. And in 2 Samuel, 1 Samuel, this is going to be fun. It's going to test me today. In 1 Samuel, Eli's boys, in verse 12 of chapter 2, became very corrupt. He's the high priest. His sons are priests, and they corrupted themselves. They're not conducting themselves admirably in taking of the sacrifices. They're not even offering them correctly. And then they even began to commit fornication with women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle. Verse 22. Eli reproved them. Why do you do these kind of things? For I hear of your evil dealings with all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him? Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father because the Lord desired to kill them. God reproved Eli for this. He reproves him in verse 27, 28, 29. I want you to read verse 29. Why do you kick at my sacrifice and my offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honor your sons more than me to make yourselves fat with the best of all the offerings of Israel, my people? That has to do with the misuse of the offerings. Jump over to chapter 3 and verse 13. And here's the passage often quoted. For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile and he did not restrain them. All I want to tell you is that passage is not saying a word about how he raised those boys when they were 5, 8, or 16. It is not a passage saying they were not restrained when they were little boys or young teenagers. He didn't restrain them then. His job as high priest was to remove those boys from serving as priests, present them to the judges of the people to be punished, and in fact, they should have been put to death for the committing of fornication. And God says, you honored them above me. You let them go on being priests. It wasn't enough to tell them no. It wasn't enough to say, you need to stop this. He had the power of the high priest to stop it. And he didn't. I don't know what kind of father Eli was. Maybe he did fail, but this text doesn't teach that. Deuteronomy 21, a son that was stubborn and rebellious and a drunkard was to be brought out to the judges of the people. The parents have said, we've done all that we can with this son. He was presented to the people and was found guilty. He was stoned to death. Bob Buchanan years ago said he talked about that, and a woman came out the doors and said, if that was true today, every one of our teenagers would be dead. He said, no, all of them but one. We've gotten their attention. But they stoned the son, not the parents. If it was the parents' fault that that boy had turned out the way that he had, stone them. Don't hold him accountable. You see, what we need to understand here is that we're all accountable. Yes, I understand. Please don't misunderstand this point. We can fail in some important ways. I don't try to teach and encourage and warn us about some of those things. And already have. But our children are going to grow up to be sinners. Your children will sin. And our goal is to raise sorry kids. Years ago, I preached that sermon with that title. One of our elders' wives in Marion, Indiana, came up to me and said, I want to show you something. She went and got it and brought it to me. Her son, Brian, had done something that he should not have done, had been reproved and disciplined by the family, and he wrote her a letter. Apparently something he did to his mom. He wrote her a letter, and he signed it, Your Sorry Son. We're training our children to learn to respond that way when they sin. Now I understand we want to help them overcome some sins that would lead to consequences that they would carry the rest of their life. And we ought to try to do that as much as we can. What about this business of raising teenagers? We've got to hang on. I loved 0 to 12. I predicted in my own mind I would not enjoy 13 or 19, and I became a self-fulfilling prophet. But I don't want to, I say that tongue-in-cheek. It wasn't that bad, but there were challenges. But please understand that for teenagers, it's challenging for them too. Not an easy time. And one of the basic reasons why we don't have to have all the science behind this, but because of hormones. Quite frankly, it's because of things like testosterone and estrogen. Adolescence. And these kids are going to go through things they've never experienced. They're going to start having feelings they've never had. And it can scare us to death how to handle the changes they're going through and trying to help them through it. My favorite illustrations of raising a teenager, someone said, an airline pilot has thousands of hours flying through the sky peacefully, as you can imagine, that's sometimes interrupted by seconds or minutes of turbulence. Horrifying. Plane drops 10,000 feet. Gets it under control. He said, raising teenagers is thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of turbulence, interrupted by a few minutes of peace flying smoothly at times. And sometimes it can feel that way. And for some, maybe it is. More than others, we talked about the strong-willed children. Let me share with you some things I think are basic principles that help us. And some of this will tie in some previous lessons. Number one, rules without relationships lead to rebellion. We do need to have a connection with our children so that we can help them through these turbulent times. It's going to be hard. But if you've developed a relationship prior to this, it's a relationship that sometimes will feel strained. And sometimes you'll wonder, what's happening here? Because again, what's happening with these children is they're growing to want a certain amount of independence. And that's genuine, it's real, it's healthy. And we're trying to help them through that. And if we've developed a relationship with them, or we have done things together, we've gone camping together, we've gone hiking together, we eat together, we worship together, then there's a connection. If that line of communication that has been opened because we've listened to our kids when they were little, when we didn't think we had the time to listen to them, tell us their silly little five-year-old stories, we need to listen so that later on they know we will. And then when they come to us and they have something to say to us or sharing their problems with us, we need to listen. And sometimes we just need to listen without instruction, without warning. We just need to make sure. And you can do that if you have developed and built up a relationship with your children. The reason I had read 1 Corinthians 13, our kids deserve to be loved like anybody else. And teenagers will need a big dose of this. They will need parents who are not easily provoked. They will need parents who don't keep tracks of wrongs. They will need forgiveness. We are supposed to forgive them. If a person is raising a teenager, say, oh, you've done it again, and do you remember last time you did this? When they have seemingly come to us and said they were sorry, that needs to be done. Past. Don't remember it. Don't keep bringing it up. They deserve that. They deserve to be to bear with them, to hope the best, to be positive in a way that says, I know you can do this. When Paul wrote Philemon, he said, I have confidence you'll do what I ask. And we need to express that to our kids. We tell them no, and we reprove them, and we correct them, and we need to do that. They need some encouragement at times, and they need to be praised for the good that they do. But along this line, they're going to make some decisions that are not going to be immoral, but they're going to just, for some of us, drive you crazy. Do not want to use illustrations of my own, only negative ones if I do any at all. I don't want to bore you with that. I can tell you one night when Amanda had gone away to college, was living 2 hours away, and on Sunday night she came in and sat down. I'm up preaching. I look back. I didn't know she was coming. I look back there. And her hair was absolutely as black as anything I've ever seen. And that is not her natural hair color. You know what my first silly reaction is? What is this girl doing? It's okay. It's okay for our kids to not like the same music we like. Obviously, we want them to be careful whether it's moral and godly, but, you know, I had one teenager come up to me years ago after I said something about rap, and he said, I want to tell you something. There's some rap that has good lyrics. I said, well, I'm sorry, I'm incapable of understanding them, but I'm glad you can. But it was okay. It's okay. We don't have to be on them all. And if we're on them all the time, if we're saying no all the time, we've got to find some things we can just say yes. We have to pick our battles. And there are some things not worth fighting for. You don't like, the clothes are modest, but you don't like them because, you know, when you were a kid, you got holes in your jeans because you were playing in them. They're buying them with holes in them. Okay. And some of them are not immodest and the holes are down about the knees and you're looking at them and think, what in the world is wrong with you? Go ahead, let them. It's okay. And so you have to work at that as a parent, trying to figure out, okay, it's okay. So that if you say yes often enough, your no's will mean something. So you have to figure that out, don't you? You have to learn that on your own. And they need to be loved. I'll tell you what else these kids need, and I've already said this, that a two-year-old needs to hear no, and they don't need an explanation because you can't reason with a two-year-old. But pretty soon, and you have to figure this out because your kids will be different, you begin to reason with them. But I can guarantee, I think I can say this with assurance, when your children are teenagers and they come to you and ask you why, you need to be able to give them sound answers. 15, because I told you so, isn't an effective response. need to be able to tell them why we think this rule is set in place. Why we have a rule that you ought not be out beyond 11:30 on Friday night. And not only that, when they have questions about the Bible and the teaching of Scripture and why we do the things we do together, they need sound answers. They need evidences and proofs. That is a biblical thing, by the way. Hebrews 11:1 tells us faith is evidence of things not seen. There are evidences that God is and that Jesus was lived and born and lived and died and was raised. There are proofs of his resurrection, Acts chapter 1, verse 3. We need to know those so we can teach our children, so they can have a basis for their faith. We understand. We want our children to have their own faith. And we want them to have that as soon as possible, because at some point, when they leave the nest, they're going to have to stand on their own faith. We need to be able to teach them that. Get as familiar as you can with the book of Proverbs and teach it and live it. Study it. Think about it. The book of Proverbs teaches about sex. Be positive. Show the positive passages along with the warnings. It teaches about money and the use of money. And sometimes, as I've told you before, it's as simple as a father telling a young married man, son, if you can't afford it, don't buy it. As my father told me when I had to have him co-sign a loan about the second year in my marriage. It warns about friends. Let the book of Proverbs do it. If you're uncomfortable talking about sex, just read it together. But the book of Proverbs is a father teaching a son. And it also includes a mom talking to her son in the latter end of the book. Tells her son what kind of woman to look for. Tells the son what kind of wife to look for. Both of them do, even the mother of the king at the end of the book, whoever that is. The book of Proverbs. Study it. Think about it. Teach your children. Now this is where my sermon's going to fail, because I got two or three quotes and I'd like to read you, and I don't have them. And I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed by that, and I'm sorry. I didn't do a very good job this morning making sure I had the right notes in my folder when I left the house. If you looked at my desk, you'd understand why. I'm going to do a better job. But anyway, they really do want guidance and discipline, but they're not going to tell you that. They want some boundaries. They want to know where the lines are. And you will be surprised what they're saying to others when tests come and they get to say, I can't do that. And they're glad they have that to go on. There really will be. The quote is, I found some material, some teenagers, and the title of the article is What Teens Want from Their Parents. And one of that points was, we want to know the rules and where we stand. We want to know them. I don't guess our first century brethren had to deal with this. I guess parents in the first century said, you know, son and honey and daughter, we're not going to the theater. They live in Ephesus. We're not going to the theater. You're not going to watch that show. We're not going to watch that play. We're not going to the library and get that book to read that book. You remember some of your brethren burned a bunch of those books a while back. You're not going to read that book. Those athletic contests you're not going to, because, again, not to be so plain to embarrass us, but we need to understand the Greek word that is translated exercise in Scripture, we get our word gymnasium from. Well, that has a good connotation to most of us basketball fans. But the Greek word meant to exercise in your birthday suit. They had public baths and places of exercise. Now, you talk about immodest. And so I can hear parents saying, no, that's not a place we're going to go to exercise. Now, the technology brings it right to us. get to sit and look at it. We need to think. We need to have healthy discussions. We need to talk about the effect that technology is having on our children just from the use of it from 2, 3, 4, 5 years old. Video games and the social media. And obviously the plague of pornography. How easy it is to find and look at. We're going to have to think about it. And kids, we care about you and we have to say no. We have to say this is going to limit the amount of time that you're on and have to give you warnings. I don't think we can take away your phones. But we need to be warning you. It can lead you down the wrong path. All technology is not wrong. Do you realize that now there's a medical term entitled digital dementia? I didn't know that until recently. That just our iPhones are affecting our learning abilities, our emotional abilities, certainly affecting the spirits. But one fellow said, you know what? I'm glad I don't have to memorize all the phone books, phone numbers. But we can't memorize one. And that's not a spiritual thing. It's more of a practical, everyday thing. He said, when I use our brain, he said, if you put your arm in your sling, after a while, your arm becomes atrophied. You can't use it. You do the same thing with your brain. And that's what's happening sometimes with our use of phones over and over and over. So all of that needs to be thought about, but it certainly needs to be thought about as our kids get older and the use of technology. Need to keep them active. Keep them busy. Got all this energy. Got all these hormones. Boys especially perhaps need to be kept active. This is again where fathers can step in and there's hiking together, there's playing together, there's camping together, there's recreation together, and I don't mean competitively. I mean just doing things together. Moms doing things together with the daughters. It includes doing spiritual things together, taking your kids with you. When you go visit someone and rake their leaves or clean out their gutters, or, you know, includes a mom having a daughter involved in the hospitality at home when they're getting ready to have company and she's in there helping them. That's a wonderful thing. It's just making sure the kids are involved and keeping them busy and active. Now that can go to an extreme too. I know that, but it's important that they have something to do. And sitting on their phone for hours isn't one of those things. You need to have some practical things, and you will come up with it. You'll see what your kids enjoy. You see, that's part of Proverbs 22:6. Do some woodworking together. You just keep them active. This is a difficult one for me. First of all, I don't want some folks to feel like I'm just getting ready for the bullseye on them already. They already feel it. I could stop here and share way too much about my own experiences and probably already have in times past and otherwise. ESPN, I saw a logo recently, ESPN ad said, life needs sports. I completely disagree. That's when something has become an idol. Are there values to be learned in competitive sports? That's debatable. I think there's some good things. I think there's some warnings. I think you can try to get your kids with coaches who are Christians and the players who are Christians, and that's all well and good. For me, that wasn't my experience. You just got to realize the influence of coaches and other players and the other children. I mean, you're around them all the time. Is it an opportunity to be a good influence? Yes. Again, I'm not suggesting it's totally wrong. But our kids need to remember, and I think these kids are smart enough to understand this, that 3% of high school athletes will play college sports and 1% of college athletes will play professionally. It won't be their life. And this quote I can remember because it was the last thing I put in my notes. The movie Hoosiers. Don't ask me why I think about that movie, but anyway. The movie Hoosiers. Early on, Jimmy Chitwood is the star player who's not going out for the team. New coach. Talking to the teacher about trying to get Jimmy to come out and play basketball. And she is just adamant about he doesn't need basketball. And what she said is, I don't want this to be the high point of his life. She said, I've seen a lot of sad old men sitting around living in the glory days. And that's not what I want for him. Now, by the way, she buys into it by the time the movie's over. But she says it just again. She's right. You don't want Thanksgivings 5-10 years from now when you're sitting around talking about the athletic successes of your kids and your grandkids, especially if they are not faithful to the Lord. We can miss it. One preacher had the audacity to ask this question in the blog, are we raising Christians or athletes? We ask that question. I told you my own experience. There was a point in time when I had a wonderful why that reminded me what was important when it came to my son. Because I was about ready to shove him right out the door. Out of my life. Because I was pushing him. And he didn't want to be pushed. And I just need to understand later on, it's okay. It's okay. And finally, you'd be glad I didn't have my notes because the sermon would have been longer. Finally, get on and let go. My hands are sweating, I think, about some of this. That's how the reaction I had, it frustrates me. I think about how it could have been better. You got to learn to let go. You learn to let go because you're going to have to let go. I know that first day of college. And there's no way I'm going to preach this sermon back in September and August. Because I remember. I remember the tears driving away and leaving my children behind. That's a good thing. Empty hands is a good thing. But we're preparing them for that moment. And in fact, we're preparing them for most accounts for them to do what we do. Because most of our kids will fall in love and get married. Some maybe you haven't yet, some hoping to, but that's probably what's going to happen. We want our children to be ready for that. Because they are going to leave father and mother and cleave to their wife or their husband. Somebody else is going to be first in their life. As I remember one illustration I had at the beginning of this, my notes is, it's amazing. A two-year-old is going off to school, and then you're walking down the aisle, and how quickly that takes place. But that can be a joyous day. Because we learn to teach them to stand on their own feet, to have their own faith, to be faithful. And they go away to college. Are they actively working with the local church? Are they doing more than just going to church? Are they faithful? Are they studying the Bibles? Those are things we're going to talk about. That's what we want from our kids. We don't have to want to be in control because you won't be. It's the testing ground. It's when we stand on the edge of the nest and go, some of them need a little more push than others. A remarkable lesson about eagles the other day from Kevin Maxey. And I didn't realize this, but eagles actually take the nest that these birds have grown up with, and at the bottom of that nest is some harder, stiffer stuff and rocks. And what they do is they go in and they stir all of that up so it's not comfortable anymore. And then that eagle gets up on the edge and it's ready to go fly under. It's time to be uncomfortable and get out of the nest and fly on their own. I should have been in white. I love that passage. That's what you want. That's what you want. You want to be able to say what John did. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk in truth. I understand the converse of that. There's probably no greater pain. No return. I'm remembering some of the things in my notes, and I'm going to stop. But may I urge you to realize you can do this. And one of my early points was, there are no mulligans, there are no do-overs, you don't get a second chance. But you can learn to do it well. You can learn for them to hit it straight. You can learn for this to happen. And I want you to understand and be positive about that and hopeful that that can happen. I thank God for the examples of those whose children are faithful. I'm sorry for those who have the pain of knowing that they're not. I don't know all the reasons why, I don't have to. But we can work together and help each other, to help our young people, help our families, to raise their children to love the Lord. And we can do it with our teenagers, but we'll have to work at it. I said one time that having teenagers was God's way of reminding me of what it was like for Him to have me as a child. To know that He still loves me and cares about me. Help me see it through. Hey, if you're not a Christian, we'd love for you to be. That's more important than anything else. More important whether you're married, have children. Wherever you are in your stage of life, God's calling you to come in faith, believe, and obey Him. Wherever you are in His parenting business, I hope we're helping a little bit. Give me some things to think. No matter where you are, God wants your faithfulness, and that's the best thing you can give to your kids. Absolutely, without question. It's the best thing you can give. Even if you're older now and your children are not faithful, the best thing you can continue to do is what you're doing. And that is remaining faithful to the Lord, giving them a chance of seeing a good example. It's still possible. It's still possible for adult children who are not faithful to come back around and love the Lord like they should. Don't give up. That's not the whole story. Can we help them? As we stand and sing, will you come if we can?